All right, everybody, welcome to the April 23rd edition of Cascadian Views. JJ is away celebrating a very special birthday, so it's just me and Dan this week. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing great. I'm ready for neoliberal shill hour, so we're going to get right to it.
Oh, it'll be fantastic. We'll talk about how much we love austerity and how we need to put those welfare people to work.
We're going to earn these George Soros checks.
We'll start off the episode, I guess, by touching on a little bit of what we discussed last week in the world geopolitics hour that we had. The French election that we discussed happened last night slash this morning by our standards. It was obviously the middle of the day for France. Before we get into the top line results, one thing I wanted to discuss is I saw some amazing pictures of people standing in line at consulates to vote abroad. I did no idea that France had that many foreign voters. There were like 50,000 people in London, like 30,000 French citizens in
Sure.
Montreal. I was very impressed with the turnout. You don't see that sort of thing in American elections, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I guess within the EU, at least for now, yeah, I'd imagine to have French people living all over Europe. Yeah, and yeah, Montreal too, a lot of French expats.
The top line results I alluded to is that, as expected, Marine Le Pen made it into the final round. Her challenger was the one that, if you read the polls, looked likely. However, it seemed to bounce around a little bit. Macron, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and I may not be, the former socialist minister who has defected from that party to form a, I guess the term would be vanity party, but I don't want to, there's negative connotations around that. He formed a party for the express purpose of running for president.
Right.
And he looks likely to pull it off. He was the top vote getter in the first round. And both the Socialist and the Republican parties in France have endorsed him now that the first round is over. It seems much like what Jacques Chirac did back in the early 2000s when he ran against Marine Le Pen's father. Same thing's happening here. Both the center left and the center right are throwing their support behind the surviving candidate to challenge the far right. Public opinion polls look like he is extremely likely to prevail in the second round, although I don't think anybody takes these sorts of things for granted anymore in the age of, say, Trump.
Right. Yeah, it's not a completely surprising result. I mean, this is in line with what a lot of the polls were predicting. Still, nonetheless, unusual that the major parties have been completely shut out of the second round of the French presidential election. Not only that, they were nearly shut out of third place, too. From what I can see, the conservative candidate, François Fillon, is running neck and neck and just barely ahead of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the far left, I guess not socialist, but what would you call him? Just the far left
Radical
candidate.
leftist, I think, would be probably the best way to put it.
Fair enough. Yeah. So not only did they get shut out of the top two, they nearly got shut out of the top three. This is, like you said, an election. We're not taking anything for granted, but the hope is that Macron is going to prevail over Le Pen in the runoff. I guess when they were running prospective polls of potential runoff scenarios, Macron tended to win over everybody, and Le Pen tended to lose it to everybody. But you've summed it up very well. In the age of Trump, nothing is really to be taken for granted.
I thought it was interesting, especially in light of these two going to the final round, that Macron ran a very explicitly pro everything Le Pen is against campaign, I think would be the
Yeah.
best way to put that. He ran as somebody who was explicitly pro European Union. In fact, he wants to continue an effort that I believe he started when he was a minister in Hollande's government some years ago, of trying to get Germany to work with France to have common finance ministers and common central banks more strongly than they already have with the European Central Bank to basically tie the EU into a much more intricately linked economy, which I think strengthens the EU, but potentially on the backs of some of the less well-off new EU states, particularly in the south of Europe. I don't know how I feel about that yet. I do definitely feel for the Frances and the, not France, for the Greeces and the Portugals of the world. But looking at what happened with Brexit, looking at even now what's happening in France with Marine Le Pen wanting to ditch the EU as soon as possible if she gets in, some sort of closer tie maybe isn't completely unwarranted, although not everybody is going to be as well off from that as the big players like Germany and France would be.
Right. Well, and I think JJ raised this a little bit last week, but it is certainly a turn to the right, no matter what, in terms of policies that go into effect from France's executive branch, no matter which of them wins. I mean, especially for Le Pen, if it's Le Pen. But Macron was certainly one of the more liberal in European terms members of the President Hollande's cabinet. I believe part of his campaign has been on doing things like raising the retirement age. Again, not, I don't know if he's actually advocating for increasing the work week, but he's certainly not taking the Mélenchon position that it should be reduced. So it's really a kind of the contest, I think JJ summed it up online, of, you know, far rightism versus neoliberalism in the I guess in the actual academic sense of the term, as opposed to the whatever a Democrat that I don't like is doing right now sense of the term that we tend to use in the United States. I mean, this is actual economic neoliberalism that's being presented in opposition to the far-right nationalism of Le Pen. However, it's pretty much the best that anyone can hope for, because Le Pen herself is an existential threat to the whole European Union as we know it.
The economic positions he advanced during the campaign are lowering the corporate tax rate from 33% to 25%. He wants to keep the legal work week at 35 hours, but allow companies the freedom to negotiate real work hours. I don't exactly know what that means. Presumably they'd pay overtime for hours above 35, or they could hire people for less than 35 hours, which I believe actually might not be allowed currently. And he would marginally cut back welfare benefits for low-wage earners, which is pretty much the textbook neoliberal austerity without looking evil game plan, I think I would say, that we have seen over the last several years with the euro crisis.
Right. It's kind of interesting to look at just the different approach that America and most European countries took to the Great Recession. Austerity was definitely put into play in most countries, especially in the UK, but to lesser extents in France, and it was forced upon a lot of the southern economies, Italy, Spain, Greece. In the United States, you know, we, as much as Obama gets derided as a centrist or, you know, kind of center left, I mean, his approach was to push through a nearly $1 trillion stimulus. I mean, it was a very different approach that was taken here. And it's not really what you'd expect given the relative orientations politically of both both regions.
It was a fairly substantial stimulus, but as a percentage of GDP, which I think is really how you measure these things,
sure,
it was more in line with something like what Germany passed during the Great Recession. Things notably Germany did not allow Greece to do to try and get out of its recession. Right. I think the argument was more Germany had its money in the bank and Greece was, you know, striving to save its life at the time. And still is to a certain extent. I don't think the situation has dramatically improved there. They're just no longer about 8 days away from going bankrupt.
Right. Yeah, it's become just a permanent crisis or a permanent emergency rather than the immediate crisis.
Well, with that, we will bounce on to the second segment here. This is the 100th day mark for the Trump administration coming up this week. This was a mark Trump campaigned extensively on. He used the first 100 days as the measuring stick he wanted people to use against him. His contract with America that he released shortly before the election included explicit plans for what would be accomplished in the first 100 days. Trump is now downplaying that immensely. He calls the 100-day mark stupid and made up by the media, and says the media is going to castrate him over it anyway, so why should he play their game? Oh, and
Did he use
also,
that term?
no,
Castrate? Okay. I was gonna
I'm
say.
being a little bit colorful, probably the same amount of colorful he is, just in a different
I was gonna
direction.
say it wouldn't surprise me coming out of his mouth,
He
so yeah.
did also say that people are counting wrong and he's not actually at 100 days yet, because he didn't start working on health care until much later, until like day 40 or so, and that
All
should
right.
really be the mark.
Sure, it's an alternate calendar. Okay.
You have alternate facts, you need an alternate calendar. I
I
assume
suppose
that's,
so.
just part of it.
Yeah.
Notably, the only measure in his campaign promise that he has been successful in getting through has been Gorsuch, has been the Supreme Court nominee. Every
Sure.
other major legislative move or even executive move has failed so far, either in the courts in the case of executive orders, or in Congress in the shape of the American Health Care Act and fairly soon tax reform and a budget. In fact, we're careening towards what appears to be another government shutdown.
Yeah, which is itself extremely bizarre. You have unified control of the government right now. It's, Republican Congress, it's a Republican president. You'd expect at least leadership from one or the other to send cues as to what needs to be passed for a budget to keep the lights on. And that is not what's happening right now. Or actually, what it sounds like is this is something that's being instigated by the Trump administration, that there are certain priorities, particularly the headline number that's been coming up is the amount for the border wall that they're pushing to see included. And they are, it's hard to say, but they seem to be trying to extort Democratic votes to get this through. That they're going to hold things like the healthcare subsidies from the Affordable Care Act hostage in order to get it.
Yeah, it's like holding a gun to your own head and being like, don't make me do it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because who's going to get blamed for a government shutdown? It's going to be the party in power. Typically, it's the president that ends up getting blamed, which.
Especially so when the shutdown is going to be over a border wall that is fairly unpopular.
Right.
Not
In order
quite as
to.
unpopular as I'd hope it would be, but still fairly unpopular.
Yeah. I mean, what I think what's unpopular about it is having us pay for it, because that was also this is breaking a promise right here. Trump swore that he was going to have Mexico pay for this border wall, and they've said absolutely not. And so instead, he's gone to Congress and said, okay, make America pay for it, or else.
There was a fantastic piece. Now I can't remember where it was. It might have been the New York Times or it might have been Politico. But they canvassed every single lawmaker in a border district, and they could not find one who explicitly supported the law.
Yeah. Well, it's a massively disruptive thing to have in your area. It serves no real purpose. And people tunnel under walls, and people get into America by other ways just than physically walking across the border. And again, towards what end? Was having a chat this morning with Ken, and he said that he'd been reading an article by some Homeland Security official from the Bush administration who had basically pointed out that when you get down to stopping immigration, that is potentially harmful to the United States. Mexico is the wall, is the border wall. I mean, that's, it's not like we get tons of immigration from Mexico itself. It's often, you know, countries, you know, further into Central America, you know, people end up trying to come through. And Mexico is where more often than not they get stopped. You know, Mexico is our wall right now. And it's this hideously alienating policy that the Trump administration is attempting to put through that seems to diminish that, I would say.
It's, they've already had bids for the wall submitted. And I actually have to say some of them were quite beautiful. Just in terms of engineering design and aestheticism. Although I do not want to see any of them viewed or any of them built, I'm a little bit worried that they're ramping up some sort of public relations thing like this. They had 3D models. In fact, I believe one of them included a VR presentation reporters could go through to explore the wall itself. Yeah, they're trying to gussy it up in a way that kind of glides over both the human cost and the economic cost to this project. And just knowing Trump's style of flash over substance, convincing people that failures were really successes, I feel like it's kind of tipping their hand on where they're going to try and go with this next.
Yeah, well, I mean, where do you think? Do you think they manage to push it through or find some other source of funding, or they drop it and walk away?
I really, especially with the fight he picked with the Freedom Caucus earlier and how it looks like he may be getting his way with that. We'll talk about this in a moment, but the Freedom Caucus is signaling that they're on board with the next healthcare attempt. I think during the same election in 2018 that Democrats are going to have trying to pummel Republicans, that'll really be Act Two. I think Act One is going to be the Trump wing of the party trying to chase out the more establishment Republicans, particularly from the border areas, over this topic. Going into re-election in 4 years, if he makes it there, this is his signature proposal. This was his campaign. This was about two-thirds of his campaign rhetoric was this wall. If that doesn't happen in 4 years, he loses a lot of face on that. I think we're going to see something like a coup is still too strong a word, but something like an attempt at changing of the guard in the Republican Party from an explicitly rightist perspective.
Right wing, as opposed to John Kasich or someone, say, opposing him from, you know, closer to the center.
I don't even think opposing him. I'm thinking he's going after his own party to get this wall built if they say no.
Huh.
I think we're going to see Trump start endorsing candidates in primaries. We already saw that a little bit in the earlier mentioned fight with the Freedom Caucus. He was explicitly floating primary these people ideas with a little question mark at the end of it, as if fishing for responses to that. I think he's going to actually pull the trigger on that if he can't get his wall funded.
Wow. Yeah. I suppose that makes slightly more sense than trying to primary members of the Freedom Caucus, but that seems like a very, very risky gambit.
I think we're already seeing some telegraphing of that. I think it was Priebus who went out just the other day and said that one way or another, the border wall is going to be funded. DHS Director, Secretary Kelly, went on board to the press and said Trump will be insistent on border wall funds in the spending bill. He's already got his front line of his cabinet out there covering for this in a lot of ways. I think this is being set up to be a you're with me or you're against me kind of moment.
Huh. That's interesting that this is where it's really gone to, and this is where the fight is going to end up being. I mean, this is kind of, I wouldn't say it's completely central to the whole white nationalist wing that Steve Bannon has been the representative of within the Trump administration, but I would think it's certainly closer to their cause than most of the other factions in the Trump White House. And supposedly, you know, that crew was on the outs, and yet this is what the fight is for right now, more than anything else. Not over infrastructure, not over tax reform, whatever that might be, but it's the border wall. You know, one of the most divisive things that Trump had promised to do.
I have a completely zero information theory about that as well, too, actually, if you want
sure.
to go deep down the make-believe rabbit hole with me here.
Let's do it.
I don't think that the reports are wrong, that wing of the White House is losing favor. Trump enjoys, just from what I've caught of The Apprentice and whatnot, make-or-break moments. I would not surprise me if he had sat Bannon down and said, you have one last chance, make this wall happen or you're gone. Giving him the keys to the driver's seat one last time just to see if he could actually achieve what he wanted to do. It would explain the sudden policy shift from a softer, more cuddly Trump. It would also give him cover if he did end up firing Bannon. You failed me. You're fired. And if he does achieve it, Trump just take all the credit for it.
Sure.
I don't believe this is true. Like I said, it's a zero information theory, but it would not surprise me whatsoever.
Get me a wall or I'm going with the New York Democrats from here on out.
He threatened to work with the Democrats on the health care bill if Republicans wouldn't go along with them, as if there was any chance that they'd want to work with him.
Yeah, just it's not the most credible threat in the world, but
it doesn't itself a credible threat. This is not his forte.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the big story of the whole 100 days, is that we've got a president and, to a large extent, an administration who really didn't know how this whole thing was supposed to work, didn't really care to learn, and now they're coming up with, you know, I think he's got a good point. You know, the 100 days is kind of a nonsense benchmark that we end up holding presidents to. But, you know, he's at it, and he's got nothing to show for himself at this point. You know, he's got Gorsuch, and that's it. And that would have been, you know, what any Republican president with a Republican Senate would have gotten through. I mean, it would have been expected. It's kind of the baseline. It's why more moderate Republicans actually pulled the lever and voted for him in the last election, was that they wanted to have a conservative justice in Antonin Scalia's seat. It's just what's expected.
Yeah, it was the central focus for a lot of the non-crazy right in getting them mm-hmm. to vote for Trump. You're 100% right on that. In which case, they may not see all this as a bad thing. If
sure.
Trump gets to appoint Supreme Court justices and not accomplish anything else, you're a middle-of-the-road Republican, you honestly might feel like that's the number one outcome you could hope for.
I think that's exactly right. God damn it. Even when they lose.
On the other hand, if that's an actual feeling among their constituents, they're going to be no shortage of pressure to rank-and-file Republicans standing up to the White House. They could get some backup from their own voters on that.
I suppose. I mean, if you want to get psychological about it, I suspect that a lot of them just voted for him to do what he's doing now, which is just be as offensive and psychically damaging to the half of the country that they dislike as possible. And whether or not he actually does anything material towards the things they supposedly want, you know, it may not matter so much. He's making liberals mad. He's making liberals scared. He's making liberals sad. And that's what counts.
I mean, I get the first one. I don't think anybody's sad or scared.
I guess it depends on, you know, which.
Okay, let me rephrase that.
Yeah, I would say communities of color are.
That was exactly where I was going to go. I was going to, you know, yeah. Yeah, no, thank you for reorientating me on that. That is exactly what I was about to say. I'm not scared. My friends aren't scared, but I am in the whitest major city in America. We just kind of want to punch some Nazis. If you're a poor black kid in, you know, Los Angeles or something, things are looking very different.
Right.
And that is something we have to keep in mind. Let's move on to the other two topics about the first 100 days. The healthcare bill is back. It is back in a slow walk, I think, probably more on the hands of Ryan than anybody else. Trump has been talking about wanting to get passed by his first 100 days. Ryan is telling everybody there's no need to rush and wants to get it done over a longer period. The Freedom Caucus is apparently about to be on board. At least their big backers and outside groups are. Heritage wants this done. Jim DeMint wants this done. The Koch brothers want this done. And I don't think there's going to be much cover for the Freedom Caucus to kill it off. That said, they have issued certain demands, but those demands aren't explicitly clear because they were framed as what the White House told us would happen has to happen. We don't know really precisely what the White House told them. It would likely include allowing states to opt out of minimum coverage rules, allowing states to opt out of pre-existing condition protection, all things which the Tuesday group has in the past said were no goes, were dead on arrival. However, the chairman of the Tuesday group was apparently involved in these White House negotiations with the Freedom Caucus. The thing we said would probably never happen, apparently happened. The White House sat both groups down in a room together and said, come up with something.
So it sounds like taking square aim, at least at the most significant regulations that comprise the Affordable Care Act, then, going back to allowing companies to sell things that they call insurance but don't really cover all that much.
In
And
fact, when you
that's,
get sick, you find out they cover basically nothing.
wow. So that is interesting. That is unpleasant news. I mean, it puts all the pressure then on the remaining, I guess, more, again, I hesitate to call them moderates or centrists, but at least the less conservative wing of the House Republicans. It puts all the pressure on them then if the Freedom Caucus is back on board.
At
Because
the
it's
same
still.
time, the concession to the Freedom Caucus, particularly the ones about reducing plans and covering pre-existing conditions, was said to be a red line for many people in the Republican caucus who supported the previous version of the AHCA and had indicated they would not be willing to support a version that did not extend those protections. So I don't know how many people off their left flank they're going to lose by trying to embrace the right flank.
And they've got no margin at all for that in the Senate. They can lose three, and that's it. So that is, well, we will see if they can actually square that circle. I mean, that's kind of been the real problem they've had to face in coming up with any kind of Obamacare repeal, is just that they want to do mutually impossible things, like things that you can't do at the same time, preserving regulations and subsidies at the same time that you eliminate regulations and subsidies.
Their other major piece that they're going to be pushing for this next week is the tax reform package. Have you been following along with that a bit?
I've seen it kind of come and go as something that they're actually going to do or not, or whether or not anyone even thinks it's still possible to do, because you're talking about a set of policies that are even more complicated than healthcare. Healthcare is what, a sixth of the economy. Taxes cover everything. So yeah, I don't have the latest details, but I think Trump was going to come up with something on Wednesday, I want to say.
Yeah, he wants it voted on and passed by the end of the week, I believe, and he's only given himself a couple days. It's very, very tightly timed.
Well, that's insane. I mean, they can't show up to people the first time on Wednesday and then get them to vote on it by Friday.
In fact, I believe the Republican caucus has a rule that bills have to be available to the public for 48 hours before they can vote on
Yeah, or even to members of Congress for 48 hours.
them.
Because I get the feeling that I would be surprised if anyone has actually seen what this is in Congress, honestly. It sounds like this is something that he turned over to his Treasury Department and said, you know, get me a bill and this is what we'll see. But yeah, I am skeptical. You know, healthcare, they could still pull a shocker, but tax reform just seems like a much heavier and crazier lift, unless it's just some kind of just slash and forget it approach, and they could probably get the votes for that. But
So that is our tightly packed upcoming week on Capitol Hill. There's a little bit more going on in the national sphere, though. We have a confirmed FISA court warrant against a Trump aide, one of the Trump campaign's senior foreign policy advisors, also specifically a senior Russian advisor, a gentleman by the name of Carter Page. You will have seen him all over the news for the last year or so. He has been largely blown off by the Trump White House once it moved into actual government. Nevertheless, he was one of the only confirmed, however, there were reportedly more, but the only confirmed target of a FISA court warrant from last year, and it was using at least parts of that, I don't know what other way to put it besides lurid dossier that was put together by the former British spy, the one that included such notable examples of Trump having, what's the least offensive way to term this, pee fun with Russian hookers?
He was, how do you want to put it? It was a
his
golden
love,
time.
I was going to say, his love for gold extended to showers as well.
Right, right.
Now, there was an interview in the wake of this with a former acting general counsel of the CIA, a gentleman by the name of John Rizzo. He was talking to Business Insider, said that in his experience in dealing with FISA processing, unconfirmed information about a potential target cannot and has not been included in any application. So if the CNN report is accurate, then I have to believe that the FBI and Department of Justice concluded and the court agreed that the info in the dossier about Page was reliable and in all likelihood was backed up by other available intelligence. We had a story just a few weeks ago about the AP partially validating that dossier, at least the parts that they could. This is more information that this isn't just all made up, I think.
Right. I mean, it doesn't guarantee that the president engages in private trickle-down economics. But it is at least some confirming evidence in support of the source. Wow. That is pretty stunning. And it just keeps building. Yeah. Drip, drip, drip.
And now,
that was not intended as a pun, but
it kind of fits the mood.
Yeah.
Page was contacted by Russian agents who were apparently grooming him back in 2013. He was interviewed by U.S. Counterintelligence officers and claimed that he had been unaware that the person he was talking to was a spy. He went to Russia to deliver a very well-received speech on behalf of Putin and the government, talking about how the West should remove all sanctions against the Russians. He was paid, I believe it's $55,000 on that. I may be wrong, however. But it was somewhere in that neighborhood, some five figures. And this was apparently what led the FBI to take another look at him. And culminated in that FISA warrant that was given out. These are not warrants that are given out willy-nilly. They are some of the most intensive requests that you will see. You often hear a fact about these warrants that the courts very rarely reject them. That is true. However, it's because they usually get the intelligence agencies to withdraw them if they think that they are lacking. most of the requests that come up before the court either have to get reworked or withdrawn completely. This isn't a rubber stamp process. This isn't politically motivated spying. This was a judge and counterintelligence officials getting together and deciding that there was probable cause to look into Carter Page's activities.
And I guess when you pull back and look at the bigger picture, I mean, that's a startling number of these figures that have some significant connection to Russian intelligence that ended up in Trump's orbit. I mean, if you want to look at it really, really charitably, I mean, you could say that his campaign just did a really terrible job of screening out some of these major potential liabilities that came around, whereas they might have tried to attach themselves to, say, a Chris Christie campaign or something like that Trump was willing to take anyone who was willing to associate with him, really, because for a while it was next to nobody.
It was Trump and his kids.
Exactly. And then a couple of goobers that he could dig up. The fellow in New Hampshire, Lewandowski, no connection to Russia, but certainly a bit of a loose cannon and not your idea of a typical Republican campaign aide.
I made a point in our pre-show discussion that if Carter Page really is a spy at this point, he's just. He can't be a spy. There are only two explanations. He's the worst spy on Earth, or he's just a dumbass. You already know that you are a target of counterintelligence activity, and he does. He was interviewed by them back in 2013 after his first grooming by Russian intelligence. You don't go and do things like, give multiple $1,000 speaking fee speeches. Sticking your finger in the eye of the West from the middle of Moscow talking about how we're treating Russia poorly. That's not the activity that somebody who's an undercover agent would do.
No. Yeah. It's a little bit too much hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, either he's
It's
playing
not even
like
at that point.
30-dimensional chess or he's just a moron.
I'm inclined to lean on the latter. Either that or just so deluded about what people might think about what he's doing or what U.S. intelligence is going to evaluate his actions. Which, that again is not uncommon for the people in Trump's orbit. Michael Flynn, for instance, was again similarly delusional about what kind of scrutiny he could expect to be under and what it would be expected of him to do. So yeah, I'm definitely leaning on either crazy or dumb as my thought with this guy. But yeah.
All right.
I don't think he's the jackal. That's
All
for sure.
right, we're going to flip into our regional coverage now and take a look around the Northwest. We've got a story out of Washington and a story out of Oregon this week. And I guess we'll start up there in your neck of the woods. Your legislature wraps up its regular session today, I believe you said, or
That's
tomorrow.
right. Right now, as we are recording, it is concluding on Sunday afternoon. And with all of the massive items on their agenda for this session, the major ones are still completely unconcluded. There is a budget from the House Democrats, there is a budget from the Senate Republicans, and they are worlds apart.
I believe there's a third budget from Inslee himself, correct?
That's right, but effectively speaking, they're going to be working between the two legislative branches, and Inslee's budget is rather closely resembles the House Democrats' budget.
I would imagine so.
Yeah, so it's going to be difficult for them to reconcile this. I mean, the path going forward, it's not really clear. You've got significant cuts still in the Republican budget. You've got a lot of significant increases in the Democratic budget in spending, but not really a way forward on paying for them. And that's actually been one of the points of contention between both houses this last week is Republicans have been saying they won't take up any action on the House budget until the House starts passing tax increases that would pay for the spending increases that are a part of their budget. So it's completely at loggerheads, and the end of the regular session is today. The state runs out of money in its budget on July 1st again, and then you start looking at partial or partial government shutdown starting July 1st of this year. So they've got just over 2 months to find some way forward on this. And we've checked in off and on the state's mandate to come up with what our state Supreme Court has called, you know, full adequate education funding. And they've had 5 years that they've been working on this now, and they're really not much closer to it today than they were back in 2013. And now they're down to basically having 60 days. Otherwise, the state Supreme Court could start taking actions like mandating that they not open schools in September, which is there was a similar row between the state legislature and the state Supreme Court in New Jersey a few years ago. And that was exactly what happened, was that they were under orders eventually not to open schools. They could not open their doors until they reached a funding resolution. And that's something that we could certainly be looking at this fall.
It seems like that's such a drastic step that hurts the kids. I mean, I get that a insufficient education is bad, but it's at the very least better than no education. And it hurts the teachers who are supposed to be employed to teach these children. It that just seems like the worst outcome possible. Fixing the budget seems so much easier.
You would hope. Yeah, I certainly do.
I question how seriously at least one half of this is taken. Taking the issue in the article you linked, Inslee appears to pull out a quote from Senator Dino Rossi, who is, I did not realize was still around. I thought I knew him as a perennial statewide candidate up there.
He comes and goes. He usually gets reappointed for state Senate positions when other office holders either leave for higher office, or in one case, I think he got appointed to a partial term when somebody died. So yeah, they keep bringing him back.
He apparently likened a budget proposal to fishing. You just have to sit and wait and you get what you want. That, at least rhetorically, is going to be a great argument to take to the population that the Republicans are being entirely unserious about this.
Yeah, that it's, well, maybe a full funding schemata will emerge, and yeah, it'll take a bite off our hook, and then we can pull it up. Until then, though, crack the six-pack, maybe get the radio going, enjoy the day. You know, it's springtime in Washington. It's beautiful.
I bet it is. This is your reminder that it has been 1,933 days since the state Supreme Court demanded that Washington fully fund its public schools.
Yep.
Fun, fun times. To turn south of the border a little bit here, since it's me and you, I thought we'd stick with the legal news this week. That is your forte and something I enjoy dabbling in, even though I know nothing official. Oregon is one of these states that caps jury awards for pain and suffering. It caps it at $500,000 currently, $500,000. There is a effort afoot in the state legislature, that's the second time I've mispronounced that word this week, to lift that cap or at least raise it completely. The Oregonian, which is having a powerhouse of a week, by the way. I'll mention some of the other things they did in our wrap-up segment. They have a piece with a woman who had complications with her pregnancy at the hospital. A series of errors that, if it weren't so serious, reads like a comedy script, ends with doctor's errors bringing on a life-threatening infection. She was in a coma. They had to surgically repair her heart. They had to amputate both legs and nine of her fingers. And something, the paper doesn't go into what, but something happened that meant she could no longer give birth to children as well. She reached a settlement with that hospital, not only covered her pain and suffering in the amount that she could get, but also got the hospital to pony up the cost of a surrogate birth at any point in the future so that she could become a parent. And the hospital has to keep her outfitted with prosthetic legs so that she can continue walking. She was one of the faces from this week, including a series of TV ads that have been put out in support of Senate Bill 737, which would lift this cap on punitive damages in cases such as this. This is a situation you're used to seeing in certain very conservative states. Capping damages is a frequent topic in discussion about lowering medical health medical health costs. They view this as a panacea to get doctors to lower rates because they say they won't have to pay as high of premiums on practice insurance and the like. Although what usually ends up happening is that prices don't really change all that much, and the people who get hurt are just screwed.
Well, exactly. I mean, because I don't, I will admit I'm not an expert on everything that goes into the course of medical billing, but I would imagine that the actual portion of it that is accounted for, that accounts for malpractice insurance premiums, I would think it's got to be just a fraction of the total cost of all the technology and personnel that go into your typical healthcare dollar. So yeah, you could, I think you could probably see significant reductions, or at least, as a percentage, pretty significant reductions of malpractice insurance premiums, and still not see much of any difference in terms of the cost that actually gets passed along to patients and their insurers.
It's a bit of a bumpy road for this cap in Oregon. It was first put in place back in the mid-80s, 1987. They created a hard cap of 500K for any non-economic damages. This was in the face of increasingly large jury verdicts across the country. One that popped up a lot of the time was the McDonald's coffee case. That's way more complicated than most people think from a soundbite, that a woman needed reconstructive surgery on her genitals, and McDonald's had been warned for years that their coffee was significantly hotter than the industry standard. I won't really get into that, but that is the backdrop against which this cap was first put into place. In 1999, our Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional for personal injury cases. But they allowed it to stand in wrongful death cases. The state legislature and citizen petitions brought it to the voters twice more to try and get it put back into place, once in 2000, once in 2004. It failed both times. However, much like many, many bad ideas that never seem to die, 2016, the Supreme Court reversed course and reinstated the cap. There's a case called Tyson Horton versus OHSU. Horton, a young man, was 8 months old. Doctors were giving him a liver surgery. Apparently screwed it up pretty bad. Almost killed him and presented lifelong health problems. The state Supreme Court ruled that it was not unconstitutional to have that limit placed on a case like that, and overturned what had been 20 years of precedent from the Supreme Court before that. This is I think the results of the elections where voters shot down trying to put it back into place should tell you how the public feels about it at this point. We're a long way from the mid-80s. That was, 30 years ago at this point. And that I think is where it's going to go if Republicans don't find a way to kill it in the legislature. Democrats are not universally behind it, but substantially behind it.
Yeah, I would expect that that should make it at least a reasonable lift for Democrats in the legislature. I mean, they do have pretty substantial majorities in both the House and the Senate. Am I right?
Yeah, they do. In the last election, we treaded water basically, but I know even during the wave years of 2014, we were the only state in the country to become more Democratic. We had
Right.
a fairly significant Democratic hold on both houses. It's not universal though. They don't hold super majorities or anything.
Yeah, I think at least there was one year where I believe in the House there was a bipartisan majority that was required, or that they were pretty much split 50-50. Anyhow, I was just looking at some of the jurisprudence that has impacted this damages cap as it's gone back and forth over the years. It looks like the issue where most of these cases have turned is on a constitutional right to a jury trial under the Constitution of the State of Oregon. And that the previous case had found that by limiting damages that could be awarded, the legislature was interfering with the rights of citizens to achieve a jury trial, which was a part of the original rights that were conferred upon Oregonians going back to 1857. It's the new court, however, that has concluded that a jury trial is actually a procedural right instead of a substantive right. It's not a right in itself, it's part of a process. And so that the legislature could, in fact, go forward and place caps on damages that were awarded without interfering with the right to a jury trial, that you can still have one. It doesn't guarantee what amount of damages can be awarded. So there's definitely some room to argue back and forth over what is the nature of the right that is at issue here. But it's definitely a step backwards in terms of what remedies are available to people that suffer some kind of tortious harm.
One of the few places in the world that you can hear tort used as an adjective.
Yep.
I'm very
And
impressed. You have definitely earned that law degree, Dan.
well, I certainly paid for it. So there's that.
To fill out our discussion, legislature, in the last election, Democrats lost one seat in November in the Senate, leaving them with a 17-13 majority. And the House stayed the same at 35-25 in favor of Democrats.
Well, yeah. Given those numbers, then, I would certainly think that a reversal is possible in this legislative session. So
I think a
let's
lot of that
keep
has to
fingers
do with
crossed.
whether or not Democrats stick together on this, or if we do have, not many, but we do have some Democrats from fairly conservative parts of Oregon. Especially the timber counties in the south that are very economically depressed, dealing with rising costs of all kinds. I think the Republican argument that this drives up medical prices might play well in those areas, and we could lose some votes.
Sure. Yeah, especially if they've got the Oregon branch of the AMA coming in and saying this is going to cause so many local docs to shutter their doors in between Medford and Roseburg, say.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting case.
So with that, I think we're going to wrap it up. We will do our stories we are following this week segment, and I'm going to, I know I don't do it very often. I always warn people to take the Oregonian with a grain of salt, but they have been on fired this week, and something I am in particular proud of them. They published a feature that's been many months in the making, dealing with a very, not going to say innovative because we basically copied it off another state, but very impressive system that Oregon had for informing the public of complaints about adult care, either memory care, adult foster homes, residential care facilities, aka nursing homes. This is something I follow a little bit nowadays. It is my job. I work in a residential care facility as a day job, so it is impacting me professionally. But the website that listed all the substantiated complaints the state had received was basically a complete failure. More than half, 60% of complaints were not entered into the system. 9 out of 10 senior care facilities in Oregon had a different score displayed than their true score based on the actual number of complaints. The agency behind the website was apparently aware of it. They did interviews with the Oregonian in the lead up to this feature piece while the reporters were reporting the story, basically acknowledging the website's a mess. They've been trying to fix it for years. They just haven't really been very vocal about it. It was basically programmed by one dude in 12 hours, or yeah, most of the work was done in 12 hours, although final launch was accomplished in about 6 months. Never had more than one actual programmer on it. The rules are fairly arbitrary and not followed in all cases. This is a baby of Jeff Merkley, formerly our Speaker of the House in the state, now one of our senators. He had substantial problems picking a facility when his father, his very elderly father, had to go through surgery, wanted a better way to do it. We copied, I want to say it was like Nebraska, but it might have been somewhere in the Northeast, and I'm just misremembering that. We basically copied their system, stuck it on a very obscure corner of the state's website underneath like six other subsites, and then just completely failed to do much about it. The Oregonian went through with Freedom of Information Act request, pulled a copy of every single complaint in paper form from the state through a records request, compiled their own database with all the ones in it, including the ones left out by the state. Apparently, these reporters actually learned how to program to do this, by the way. They spend a little bit of time in the article talking about that, which is cool, if a little out of place in that article. But they put together a much better, much usable, more usable list and have shamed the state in a little bit in their way of handling this, and I think that is completely deserved. I think the Oregonian did a great job. I think the state really screwed this up, and they've been getting major props for it. I do have to say, I punched in the facility I work at. Never a single complaint, so I'm pretty proud of that one.
Huh.
The feature article hit on Thursday morning, and I've been just kind of poking around with it since then. There are some horrible senior care facilities around the state. Looking through some of them, horrible. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of great ones. I work at one now, but there are a large number of places with complaints averaging like one a month or so for some of these places.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a very vulnerable population, and yeah, without due diligence, that can just become a real horror show.
Yeah, they even like digitize it into map forms so you can look around and judge by color which facilities are the good ones, which are the bad ones. I highly recommend checking it out, even if it's just to educate yourself.
Wow, okay, sure.
All right, Dan, what are you following?
All right. Well, I haven't got a whole lot this week. I am keeping an eye back on our former home up in Alaska. We've mentioned that the Washington legislature is just concluding this week or today. The Alaska legislature actually finished their regular session last week, and they are already in special session and looking ahead towards fixing the many issues that they have. Well, not a lot of issues, just it's their very deep fiscal hole that they're trying to get concluded this year, or at least make some progress on filling. They're in special session right now. One of the historic things that they've done this year is for the first time in decades, the state house passed a measure instituting a state income tax. You know, the first statewide levy on citizens since the 1980s. And it's supposed to be up for a hearing shortly in the Senate, at least for consideration. They've got at least a somewhat similar dynamic to what we have here, except it's a little more lopsided. They've got a considerable, tripartisan majority in the House and a massive Republican majority in the Senate. So at least the dynamics of trying to reach across parties in order to get anything done is very much in place there as well. So I'll be seeing how well history gets made up there in the next few weeks as they try to find a way to deal with oil prices and production that are so much lower than they've required in order to historically fund their government. And I'm hoping that sometime after the session is through, we might be able to bring back old friend of the show, Justin Parrish, on to give a wrap-up of how he thinks they did.
I would love to hear the report of his first session in the legislature.
Absolutely.
I haven't actually seen that guy since we were in The King and I together, I don't think.
Wow. High school.
Yeah. No, I mean, I heard his voice when he was on the show a while back, but I don't think I've hung out with him since I was, like 16.
I was his dungeon master about 3-4 years ago, so.
Oh, man. I would love to, play those pen and paper RPGs again. It's been a while.
Good times.
When I first moved to Portland, I auditioned with a group out in Hillsboro to join, and I thought it went well, but apparently they interviewed like 5 people, and I was not the one who made the cut. That's a scarlet letter, man. As a geek, when you get rejected from a role-playing group, it feels like somebody broke up with you.
Yeah, it's harder to make those connections as an adult, you know?
Yeah, especially in a city you like just dropped yourself into.
Sure.
All right. Well, maybe we'll spring for a copy of like Tabletop Simulator or something. I'll see if I can talk a group into it. All right, Dan. Thanks for joining me this week. We'll have JJ on next week. Special shout out to anybody who's tuning in for the first time from the podcast guest newsletter. You guys enjoyed the show, want to come on, talk about your pet project, feel free to include the link that was in the newsletter, submit your information, I'll be in touch. Dan might be in touch, JJ might be in touch. I'll be linking the results from that in our organizing group, so anybody who wants to can fish through that. All right, this has been your April 23rd edition of Cascadian Views. I'm Brock, that's Dan. We will see you guys next week.
Have a great one.
Have a good one.